Harper Audio presents Tiny Pretty Things by Sona Charipatra and Danielle Clayton. Performed by Imani Parks, Nora Hunter, Greta Young, Laura Delano. Cassie. It always feels like death, at least at first. Your muscles stretch and burn until they might rip. The bones in your hips threaten to rotate right out of their sockets. Your spine lengthens and twists into impossible shapes. The veins in your arms swell, blood pulsing through them. Your fingers tremble as you try to hold them taut but graceful, just so. Your toes jam into a pretty pink box, battering your feet with constellations of blisters and bruises. But it all looks effortless and beautiful. I hope. Because that's all that really matters. Studio B is a fishbowl today, and I wish the three glass walls were blacked out or covered up. I can feel Liz's glare, hot and heavy, her face pressed up against the glass. I knew she wanted this. Maybe even more than me. But that doesn't mean she deserved it. She'll claim that I got lucky, that it was nepotism, that being Mr. Lucas's niece has its perks. I mean, Bette told me she said as much in her drunken babblings last night. But I know better. I earned this. Morky barks orders at the core girls, then turns to the pianist to nitpick a chord pace for the spring ballet, La Sylphide. I'm the only level 6 girl cast as a soloist, and while the others pretend to be happy for me, well, most of them anyway, I know they're hoping to see me fail. But I won't give them the satisfaction, even though it's hard being the youngest one in here, and earlier, when one of them asked me if I was 15, I wanted to lie and say I was 17 or 18 like them. As I watch the other dancers spin across the floor in a series of pirouettes, I keep my smile plastered across my face. I won't falter. I can't let them know how hard this is. My muscles ache and my stomach churns, empty from a morning spent reliving last night's revelries. I never should have let Bette talk me into drinking. I'm definitely paying the price now. The music stops abruptly, and Morky towers over Sarah Takahashi, making her do the turn over and over again, yelling corrections in Russian like Sarah understands her. Sarah bows, and it seems to infuriate Morky even more. She's my understudy and a level 8 girl. An 8 girl should have had the lead, an opportunity for the company masters to see her talent and offer her a spot. I take every second of this break to review the variation in my head, to think through the music. Morky does the steps one by one, stamping her little heeled ballet slippers. Even nearing 70, she's still a strong portrait of grace, a true danseuse russe. Bette slips through the door, and she lets it bang closed so I know she's here. I hate how she always finds a way to announce herself, but I could never tell her that. Everyone watches, her halo of blonde hair pulled taut in its bun, her designer dance skirt floating around her like cotton candy, her pink lipstick expertly applied. She's told to find a spot in the back and plops down right near the dance bags. There were rumors that a fat check from her mom secured her a seat in the studio to learn the role too, but I didn't dare ask her. She's been so gracious and helpful, defending me to Liz and the others when I first got here, showing me the ropes, threatening the other girls if they didn't stop messing with me. Will enters a few moments after. His red hair is gelled up, and he's wearing a face full of makeup. He blows me a kiss and waves. It was announced this morning that he'd be my paw partner's understudy. He sits in the back with Bette. Morky calls me to the center. The music starts, light and fluttery and serene. Usually I let it take me, the notes lifting me away so I'm no longer myself. The movements of my arms and legs transforming, allowing me to become the forest fairy romancing the Scotsman. But today, I'm very much anchored in my too-tall, lumbering body. I can feel the pull in each muscle as I glide across the floor, trying to make sure I land every step in the right spot. I catch myself looking down at the tape marking the stage placements, focusing on the counts in the music. I try not to think of each precise motion making up the variation. Old habits, bad habits. I should know this by heart now. I tell myself I'm as light as air, but my feet are a second too slow, my arm movements too heavy. "More, more," Morky yells, her voice bouncing off the mirrors. I feel my smile falter. I'm totally graceless in her presence. My confidence seeps out of me with my sweat. Scott waits for me stage left. I flitter over to him, presenting my hand. He pulls me into his chest. Morky yells over the music. "Smile, you're in love with him." My grin looks pained in the mirror. My stomach muscles clench when his hands squeeze my waist as he prepares to lift me. Morky waves her hands in the air. We stop mid-lift. "You're supposed to be in love. Where is it? Where is it?" she says, motioning me out of the center. "Did we make mistake in casting Cassandra?" Her Russian accent makes the word sharp, tiny knives that tear into my sides. "Find it. Find the reason we picked you." She waves me away with one skinny arm. Sarah takes my place with Scott to practice the flying shoulder lift I couldn't do. I tell myself that it's fine, necessary. Both boys have to learn how to lift Sarah, then me. Just in case. Frustrated, I head to the back corner, toward Bet and Will. "You've got to," I hear her whisper, but he shushes her as he watches me approach. "Hey," he grins, patting the floor next to him. "Rough start, huh?" I catch my breath, wiping away the little beads of sweat on my top lip. As Bet's ice-blue gaze settles over me, I feel disgusting and heavy and off. Will gives me a sad frown, like I'm a puppy who's just been kicked. "Don't take it to heart," he whispers again. "Morky's a beast." "You okay?" Bet asks, offering a smile that's half grimace. "I don't know where it all went," I say, closing my eyes. I stretch my limbs out every which way. "I was fine yesterday. You saw me." "You look scared of him," Will says, his eyes on Scott, tracing his every movement. "Have a little crush."
"I have a boyfriend," I snap without meaning to. I wish I was partnering with Henri, but he's at the Paris Opera School.
I trust his hands.
"Sorry, I can't figure out what's wrong with me."
Bet says, noncommittal.
"Too much alcohol is my guess."
And it makes me remember how she kept filling my cup with the expensive wine she'd taken from her mother's collection, despite my protests. I nod my head, eager for an excuse.
"I should have gone straight to bed after we hung out."
"You didn't?" Her forehead crinkles with surprise. "Sometimes I dance late at night, so it can all stick in my head when I finally sleep." I put a hand on my forehead, not sure why everything is coming out of me right now. But I can trust her. Alec told me so. Even when I doubted Bet at first, and Will is Alec's best friend. My legs are a mess. I scoot over a little, pressing my back against the glass wall that faces out onto the street. The warmth of sunbeams erases the cold that settled in my stomach. Even though it's spring, I'm shivering.
What should I do?
Bet and Will share glances. They know what Morky wants. They've been here forever. They know how to please her.
"You need to get it together," Bet says, picking invisible lint off her impeccable sweater.
Morky doesn't do drama or excuses. She leans into a stretch, warming up as if she'll be called to the center at any second, as if she's here for a reason.
"And you need to not drink so much."
"Ouch, Bet," Will says. I try to keep the shock off my face.
"I actually never drank before," I tell her in a whisper.
If Bet is surprised, she doesn't let it show. But it's humiliating to say it. Before I came to New York and moved in with my cousin Alec and his family to go to the conservatory, my whole world was just dance class and school and sitting on the couch with my British host mother, waiting for a call or text from Henri. New York is totally different from London. I didn't know it would hit me that hard. I want to call Bet out for pushing the wine on me, but I don't. She's pretty much the only real friend I've made since I've got to New York, and I'm not about to mess that up.
"Some days we're just off,"
Will says, and pets my leg like that will help. I feel my eyes get watery. I lick the strawberry gloss off my lips, hearing my mom's scolding voice in my head as I do it. She says it's totally unladylike. I look over my shoulder and watch Sarah Takahashi nail the lift with Scott that I couldn't. Morky beams at her. Don't worry, Cassie, Bet says. Will can help you look good out there. He'll rescue you like he's always done for me. The word rescue lands hard. Will's eyes dart around the studio like he's watching a fly. Bet flashes me a smile that's so big I can see all her teeth. Perfect, just like the rest of her. I'm called back to the center, and now Will is too. I can feel Bet's gaze following Will as Morky shows Will and me the next part of the paw. We mark the movements one at a time with painful precision. It takes me almost an hour to perfect them the way Morky wants them before she lets us try on our own. Then finally, I stand in the center ready to show her what I've learned. I prepare to dance, waiting for the chord of music to start moving. My mind quiets. The worries, the criticisms, the faces in the glass all drift away. I see Will ahead waiting for me. I pretend that it's Henri. I step into my first movement, folding myself into the music, each arm motion embodying the cadence. I jump and turn and leap and glide. I flutter over to Will. Right on the melody, Morky yells. Will's hands find my waist. He lifts me up into a flying shoulder lift. His right shoulder presses into my butt, carrying my weight, effortless. She's not a box, William, Morky says. She's a jewel. Carry her like one, so pretty, so light. His fingers press into my hip bones as he struggles to hold me there. Beautiful, beautiful, Morky yells over the music. Smile, Cassandra. I smile as hard as I can. I keep my eyes on the mirror and focus on Morky's instructions. Here comes the fish dive, slow, graceful, deliberate. Except it's not. Will's not supporting my weight anymore, and I wobble, trying to counterbalance, but it's too late. His fingers feel like they've disappeared, not at all like we've practiced. With his support gone, my right leg drops. I topple, like I've fallen off the edge of a cliff. The floor feels so far away until I hit it.
Act 1. Fall Season. Chapter 1. Bet. They say anticipation is sometimes sweeter than the actual event, so I'm going to enjoy every moment of the waiting. Mr. Case certainly loves dragging it out. We swarm around him in the American Ballet Conservatory lobby, waiting for his annual speech on the Nutcracker. Then he'll reveal the student cast list. Twice a year, in the fall and the spring, students get to replace the company dancers for a night at Lincoln Center. A test of our mettle, a taste of our future. That piece of paper basically sums up your worth in our school, the American Ballet Company Feeder Academy. And I'm worth a lot. Alec and I hold hands, and I can't contain my smile. In just a few moments, my name is going to be on the wall next to the role of the Sugar Plum Fairy, and the rest of my life can finally begin. I saw my older sister, Adele, dance the role 6 years ago, when I was cast in the part of a cherub and bouncing around in gold wings and my mother's lipstick. Back then, the anticipation wasn't the best part. Back then, the best part was the heat of the lights on my skin and the presence of the audience before us and dancing in perfect time with my little ballet girlfriends. The best part was the scratchy tights and the sweet metallic smell of hairspray and the sparkling tiara pinned into my baby fine hair, the glitter dusted onto my cheeks. The best part was the whole of nervousness in my stomach before getting on stage, and the rush of joy after we pranced off. The best part was bouquets of flowers, and kisses on both cheeks from my mother, and my father lifting me in the air and calling me a princess. Back then, it was all the best part. The school's front doors are closed and locked. Mr. K's speech is that important. I glance over my shoulder through the big lobby windows and see a few people with red noses, bundled up to fight the October air. They're stuck on the stairs and in the Rose Abney Plaza, named after my grandmother. That door won't open again until he's finished. They'll just have to freeze. Mr. K rubs his well-groomed beard, and I know he's ready to start. I know these little things about him, thanks to Adele, a company soloist. I straighten up a bit more and wrap my hand around Alec's neck, tickling the place where his buzzed blonde hair meets his skin. He grins, too, both of us perfectly poised to finally take our places as the leads in the winter ballet. "This is it," I whisper in his ear. He smiles back and kisses my forehead. He's flushed with excitement, too, and I just know that from here on out, I will love everything about ballet again. Both of our auditions went well. I remember how ridiculously happy Adele looked when she was dancing the Sugar Plum Fairy, and how the role got her plucked straight out of the school and given a spot in the company, and I just dream of feeling that full. There's no one standing in my way. Even Liz is struggling a little bit this year, and no one else can do what I can. I drop my hand down to his and squeeze Alec a little tighter. Alec's best friend, my ex-friend, Will, glares at me. Jealous. Parents and siblings grow quiet, standing behind the expanse of black leotards. "Casting each of you in the Nutcracker isn't just an exercise in technique," Mr. K begins. Our ballet master speaks slowly, like he's just deciding on the words right now, even though he gives some version of this speech every year. Yet I cling to every word as if I've never heard it before. Mr. K is the single most deliberate human being I've ever met. He makes eye contact with me, and I know my fate is cemented in that quick connection. That look my way is purposeful. It has to be. I bow my head a bit with respect, but can't stop the edges of my mouth from doing their own little upward pull. "Technique is the foundation of ballet, but personality is where the dance comes to life. In the Nutcracker, each character serves an important purpose to the ballet as a whole, and that is why we take such care in assigning each of you the perfect part. Who you are comes across in how you dance. I'm sure we all remember when Gerard Selling danced the Rat King last winter, or when Adele Abney danced the Sugar Plum Fairy. These were seminal performances that displayed unbelievable technique as well as exquisite joy and beauty. The students stopped being students and transformed into artists, like a caterpillar leaves its chrysalis and becomes what it was designed to be, a butterfly." Mr. K calls us his butterflies. We're never his students, dancers, athletes, or ballerinas. When we graduate, he'll give the best dancer a diamond butterfly pendant. Adele still only takes hers off for performances. "It is because of Adele's and Gerard's relationships to the roles of Sugar Plum Fairy and Rat King that they experienced such success," he adds. "It was the connection they forged with the part." I bow my head even farther. Mr. K talking about my sister is another deliberate nod to me. I'm sure of it. Adele's performance as the Sugar Plum Fairy has been a topic of conversation since the first night she'd performed it 6 years ago. She was only in level 6 ballet and hadn't even turned 15 yet. It was unheard of for such a young dancer to be given such a role over the older level 8 girls. And when I was that 7-year-old cherub hugging my sister with my fiercest pride and congratulations, Mr. K approached us both with a confident smile. "Adele, you are luminous," he'd said. It's a word I have been itching for him to call me ever since. He still hasn't. Not yet. "And darling little Bet, I can tell from your lovely dancing tonight that, in no time at all, you will be following in your sister's footsteps, a Sugar Plum Fairy in the making." He'd winked, and Adele had beamed at me with agreement. He is surely referring to that moment now. He is letting me remember his prediction and assuring me that he had been right all those years ago. I shift onto my tiptoes, unable to suppress that bit of excitement. Alex squeezes my hand. Mr. K's voice softens. Young Clara, for instance, must be sweet and invoke the wonder of Christmas with every step and glance. His gaze drifts to a pretty petite rat in a pale blue leotard, her dark hair in a perfect bun. She blushes from the attention, and I'm happy for tiny Mara's moment of joy. I played Clara when I was 11. I know the thrill, and she deserves to experience every second of it. Years later, I still think of that performance as the most fun I've ever had. It was right after the Christmas season that my mother started showing me old videos of Adele and asking me to compare my technique to hers. It was that Christmas when everything between my mother, Adele, and me shifted beyond recognition, distorting into a bad TV drama. I get a little lightheaded just thinking about it. I can still hear the whir of the X-ray camera like it was yesterday. Looking too hard at those memories isn't a good idea, so I close my eyes for an instant to make the thoughts disappear, as I always do. I give Alex's hand another squeeze and try to focus. This is my big moment. Uncle Drosselmeyer must be mysterious and clouded. A man with a secret, Mr. K says. The Nutcracker Prince should be regal and full of confidence. Untouchable and elegant, but still masculine. Mr. K looks then at Alec, who breaks out into a fully dimpled grin. He is describing Alec to a T, and I lean against him a bit. He lets go of my hand and wraps his arm around my shoulders. As if this moment weren't wonderful enough, Alec's affection has me soaring even higher. Mr. K lists off a few more characters and the necessary qualities the dancers must bring to them. I smooth my hair to make sure I look perfect for my big moment. And the Sugar Plum Fairy, Mr. K continues, his eyes searching the crowd. She must be not only beautiful, but kind, joyful, mysterious, and playful. His eyes are still searching the crowd, which is strange since he knows exactly where I am. I try to dismiss it as a bit of Mr. K playing around, as he's known to do. The Sugar Plum Fairy's ideal qualities, they're not mine. They are not words anyone has ever used to describe me. But the part is mine. I know it is because of the way Mr. K finishes his speech. Above all else, he says, the Sugar Plum Fairy must be luminous. I squeeze Alec's hand again. That is me. I am luminous, like Adele. It is me. It has always been me. But still, Mr. K's eyes do not find their way to mine.
Chapter 2. Gigi. I nibble at my bottom lip until I taste blood. The spot is a tiny heart thumping harder than the one in my chest. My teeth sink into the cut despite the sting, and I can't stop. I won't go to the bathroom to see how bad it is. I can't miss all the excitement. I can't be anywhere else. Shoulder to shoulder, we are a sea of paper-thin bodies. One large gust could push us around, like the fall leaves tumbling past the lobby's picture windows. We are that light, that vulnerable, that afraid. Nervous excitement flutters through me. Even the little ones, the petit rats, gnaw at their fingernails, and the boys hold their breaths. The gurgles of half-empty stomachs churning a ballet diet of grapefruit and energy tea invade small pockets of silence when Mr. K finally pauses. All showmanship. We listen intently. The occasional whisper is a firework. The melody of his Russian accent makes the words feel heavier, more important. He paces before us, waving his hands in fiery motions, and leaving the scent of cigarettes and warm vodka wrapped around us. I fixate on every word coming out of Mr. K's mouth like I could catch each one in a mason jar. Our other teachers are lined up behind him. Along with Mr. K, there are five of them that decide our fates. The piano accompanist, Victor, the lowliest of the lot. His smile holds a cigarette, and he barely speaks but knows everything. All the things they think of us. Then Morky and Pavlovich, our ballet madams. We call them the twins, though they're not related and look nothing alike. Their narrow eyes flit over us, ever so briefly, as if we're ghosts they don't quite see. Lastly, there's Mr. Lucas, the board president, Alec's father, and Dubrava, the other male teacher. Mr. K concludes his speech by congratulating us on making it through the audition process, like the budding professionals we are. They all retreat into the admissions office. Someone whispers that they've gone to get the cast list. The open space feels lighter without them in it. Everyone starts to talk softly. I hear the words new and black and girl whispered in various combinations. After 1 month here at school, the first major casting makes me feel my skin color like a fresh sunburn. I'm the only black ballerina aside from a little one named Maya. Most times, I try not to think about it because I'm just like everyone else, classically trained, here to learn the Russian style of ballet, with a shot at moving from the school to the company. But my skin color matters here more than it ever did at my California studio. Back there, we held hands while waiting for the cast list and hugged each other with hearty congratulations. Aurora and Sleeping Beauty, Khichri and Don Quixote, Odette and Swan Lake came in all colors. There were no questions about what looked best on stage. There were no questions about body type. There were no mentions of the Russians' love of the Bella Blanc, an all-white cast on stage to create the perfect effect. Here we tug our hair into buns. We all wear colored leotards that signal our ballet level. We put on makeup for class, and we only learn the Vaganova style of ballet. We follow traditions and age-old routines. This is the Russian way. This is what I wanted. This is what I begged my parents to send me across the country for. My best friend Ella from back home says I'm crazy to come this far just to dance. She doesn't understand when I tell her that ballet is everything. I can't imagine doing anything else. Someone whispers, "Who will he choose to dance the Sugar Plum Fairy?" But she is quickly hushed. Besides, we all know that it will be Bette. Everyone wants a soloist part. Everyone wants to be the prima ballerina of the American Ballet Conservatory. Everyone wants a spot in the company. Everyone wants to be Mr. K's favorite. Even me. The moon stares in through the glass, even though it's barely past dusk. At home, it's still the afternoon. Mom is just finishing up in her garden about now. I wonder if she's waiting for the cast list news, too, and if she's finally getting excited about me being here. She wanted me to keep dancing at my local studio, keep ballet a fun after-school activity. "You could permanently hurt yourself," she said before I auditioned for the conservatory, as if the rigor of ballet is like falling off a bicycle. "You could get sick. You could die." Death is her favorite threat. I fight the nerves. I fight the feeling of homesickness that creeps up on me. I fight the weird knot forming in my throat as I look around, and it sinks in that I'm the only black ballerina in the upper ballet levels. I'm lonely here. Most of these kids have been at the school for years, like my roommate, June, and Bette, and Alec, who will most likely be cast as the leads this year. I watch Bette lean her golden head against his, a match set, and hear her sigh, content, knowing that her big moment is coming. I suppressed a little pang. I just got here. I'm the new girl. I shouldn't want what she has. The role, or Alec, but I can't help it. I look away, trying to find somewhere else to put my thoughts. I stare up at the hundreds of black and white portraits of the American Ballet Conservatory graduates who went on to be apprentices, soloists, and principals in the American Ballet Company. They cover all the walls in the halls here, looking down on us, showing us what we could become if we're simply good enough. In the almost 50 years of history on the wall, there are only two other black faces in a white sea. I will be the third. I will earn one of the few spots in the company saved for conservatory members. I will show my parents that every part of me can handle it. My hands, my feet, my mind, my legs, and my heart. I scan the crowd for my Aunt Leah, who is decked out in leggings and a hand-knitted sweater dress. I can hear her voice above the others, a little too loudly introducing herself to other parents and guardians as Mama's younger sister and an art curator at a Brooklyn gallery. She grins and waves at me. With her pink knit hat and freckly brown skin, she's as much an outsider as I am in this lobby, and she's been a New Yorker for decades. I wave back. The girls around me tense up. My roommate June moves a small step away from my side. Even my waving is too loud, but I don't care. The office door cracks open, its squeaky hinges hushing everyone. We all gasp. I put a hand to my chest. Clapping echoes through the room as he re-enters. Mr. K's pretty secretary walks to the board with a sheet of paper, her arms outstretched to tack it up. Mr. K looks around. Prachdite. Vit, vit. He raises his hand before she exposes the page. He crisscrosses between us. He's dark, almost ominous, dressed in all black. Anton Kozlov, a danseur russe. Frantic energy bubbles through me. The other dancers squirm in part, giving him way. I drop my head, my body still jittery whenever he comes near. I haven't quite overcome it. I will my hands to settle. I will my muscles to relax. I will my heart to slow. Beside me, I hear other girls' breathing accelerate. We are one sphere of nervous, nauseous focus. I try to use Mama's calming technique, listening to the noise inside our gigantic pink conch shell. I picture my dad finding it in Hawaii that summer. I attempt to listen for the gauzy melody, but the calm doesn't come. I hear footsteps, then see my reflection in the toes of two black shoes. Two of Mr. K's long fingers lift my chin, and I meet his mottled green eyes. Sweat dots along my hairline. I feel dried blood mar my mouth like a tiny streak of Mama's paint. All eyes turn to me. Our ballet madams watch. The parents go silent, including my Aunt Leah. I lick my cut, hoping to stop the pulsating thrum. Mr. K's face looms right above me. Heat gathers in my cheeks. I can't escape his gaze. He holds me there, and everything slows.
Chapter 3. June. I don't mind that Mr. K's interrupted his speech to lift Gigi's chin and force her to pay attention. It's terrible. But I like seeing her get in trouble for her California spaciness. Serves her right. He didn't say a word, but I know he's sending her a warning. Tune in. Always. I sip tea from my thermos to hide my smile. The bitter omija herbs warm my irritable belly, calming the bile that's constant company. I fight the urge to retreat to the bathroom and escape to the cold comfort of porcelain and an empty stomach. But I can't afford to miss this moment. I have to know where I am now. Mr. K's secretary holds the page close to her chest, as if we'd attack her for it, and maybe she's right. Luminous, he says, then goes on to repeat it five more times, asking dancers close to him to define it, to describe what it means on stage, or else he'll delay the casting announcement even further. They quake and stutter, unable to answer him. If he'd have asked me, I'd have known just what to say. To be luminous on stage means to glow, to shine, to own it. It's a quality few among us possess, but I know I'm among the very few. Still, they don't give me the roles I want, no matter how well I think my auditions have gone. But it's only a matter of time. A tingle tickles its way up my spine. The worry, the anxiety, the nerves. I savor it. My classmates, they're all stupid and empty-headed, wrapped up in their emotions, unable to see things clearly. They don't pay attention. If they had, they'd already know whose name will be written in each spot. Mr. K never changes. Those who have been here forever know his habits, his choices, his patterns. Newbies don't stand a chance. Ballet is about routine, training the muscles to obey tiny commands. I've been here since I was 6, shuttled back and forth from Queens until I got old enough to live in the dormitory above us. I know the drill. It all comes down to this, the casting of the Nutcracker. The first ballet of the school year. This one starts the game. I can't wait to finally be in it. By now, the American Ballet Conservatory is more like home than the two-bedroom apartment in Flushing that I shared with my mom. I know the studios, the academic classrooms, the cafe, the student lounge, my corner bedroom. I know that the elevator won't take you to floors 13 to 18. I know every staircase exit that lets you onto boys' dorm floors, all the dancers in the black and white photographs, quiet places to study or dark corners to hide from the RAs, the best places to stretch or make out. Not that I'm doing much making out. Or any, really. The lobby crowd thickens with more adult bodies. Parents. Someone opened the door for them. They're here to pick up the petit rat, or to nose around to find out who got what role. When Mr. K's ex-wife, Galina, a retired Paris opera ballerina, was here, she'd block the door and gather us, her petit rat, all around her, willing us to be silent as we watch the older girls get cast. Any serious dancer tells their parents to stay in the far hallway or even better, just wait by the phone. Mr. K doesn't like when we act like children who need mommies. We may be young, he says, but we're supposed to be professionals. My parents are not here, of course. My mom refuses to set foot in the atrium. When she does come, she just pulls up out front of the school and makes me take the rice cakes, the endless packs of seaweed, and tea she's brought for me from the car. And I don't have a father. Gigi's big-haired aunt keeps inching closer and closer to us students, and I can hear her talking. It's distracting me from hearing Mr. K explain how difficult it was for him to choose student roles this semester. I let my eyes burn into the back of Gigi's head. I want to tell her that she should have clued her aunt in and told her not to talk until after the cast list is revealed. I want to whisper under my breath, "조용해." Be quiet, just like my mom always does. I need to hear every word out of Mr. K's mouth. His announcement will show how far I've come, what he thinks of me now. Mr. K pauses and the parents clap awkwardly. He nods, placing a finger to his mouth. Maybe he'll add something new. Probably not. I could give the spiel myself, and I know his cast list before his little blonde assistant tacks up the page. Gigi shakes in front of me, trembles working their way down her back and legs. She's like one of the petit rats at the front of the pack. I feel her fear and excitement. Mr. K will cast her as Arabian coffee, just like the other brown girl from 2 years ago. Gigi's exotic like her. Can't even remember her name. She gave up so quickly once it all got tough. She complained it was so lonely being the only black girl at school. Try being the only half-Asian ballerina. Not quite right anywhere. That's tough. And Mr. K's just predictable enough to put minorities in ethnic roles. He'll cast the pack of Korean girls as Chinese tea. But my face isn't Asian enough to join them. And I wouldn't want to. I want to be as far away from them as possible. Everyone knows Bed Abney will be the sugar plum fairy. Ever since her sister landed it when we were kids, no one has stopped talking about her performance. And the mean girls always get what they want here. Bet isn't anywhere near as luminous as Adele, but that's what Mr. K will do. Her feet are good, quick and light, and she is undeniably elegant. Even though we aren't friends, and never have been nor will be, I actually wouldn't mind seeing her as the Sugar Plum Fairy, if I had to lose the role. Bet has a razor-sharp edge. It's a fascinating contrast to her sweet doll-like face and stately pedigree. Her lapdog roommate Eleanor will be her understudy and nothing else, of course. And Bet's clone, Liz Walsh, stands two bodies away from me in consummate formation. Chest out, soft hands at her sides, and feet in first position. Her body ballet perfect. An icy brunette, she'll be just right for the Snow Queen. But even though she looks relaxed, Liz's eyes are wild, darting about the room, and I'm glad I don't have to feel that desperation. No matter how many knits she piles on, it won't hide her underweight body. I sip my tea, happy it leaves me satisfied, without the pains of hunger. The white girls don't know much about diet teas from Asia. They fill themselves with calorie-packed American brands. We should tell them, but of course we don't.
Mr. K, come on already, Alex shouts out. Let us see the list.
Mr. K breaks out in a smile. Only blonde and blue-eyed Alec can get away with that. His father stands beside the other male ballet teacher with a bright grin on his face. Alec is the son of the president of the board of trustees. He can do what he wants. Alec heckles Mr. K once more. He will be the Nutcracker Prince and he will dance with Bet. It makes sense for the only couple in our grade to dance together. Of the 16 girls and 6 boys in the junior class, only 2 of the boys are straight. The new superstar boy, Henri, and Alec. Bet beams and touches the side of Alec's face like some doting wife, and Alec's best friend, Will, jostles his shoulder. Bet thumbs her silly locket, the one she's worn forever. It was probably a gift from Alec. I touch my bare neck. The only jewelry I ever want is Mr. K's butterfly pendant. Red-headed Will, of course, will be relegated to playing old Drosselmeyer. Slack-chested and delicate, Will could dance the female variations better than most of the girls in our class. If allowed on point, he would. His eyeliner is always expertly applied, and he possesses a grace most of our class would kill for. But Mr. K and Dubrava frown at him. And until he becomes super masculine, a true male danseur russe, he'll keep getting stuck there. Mr. K steps into our midst once again. He's winding us up for the big finale. He's finally ready to tell us. Dancers shuffle out of his way. Gigi keeps throwing glances back to that aunt of hers, and she almost does a jump with excitement. She'll learn soon enough not to do that here. Never show how you feel about a particular role. People are watching. Always. They'll take what you want. Mr. K stops at Henri, glaring at the mess of hair around his shoulders. Even though the dance mags have called him the next great ballet star, a mini Mikhail Baryshnikov, we still treat him like he's nothing. He came for the last summer session. Henri says something in French and gathers his dark, shaggy hair into a ponytail. He used to date Cassie Lucas. I shudder, thinking of what the girls did to her last year. How we all have to suffer through those seminars on competition now. He doesn't talk to anyone, and no one wants to talk to him anyway. Guess they worry he knows the things that happened to his girlfriend, that he might tell someone who matters. Ballerinas have their secrets. He has a mean glint in his eyes. I would cast him as the Rat King just because of that. While Mr. K inspects a few others, the room simmers and bubbles into a rolling boil. I review all the major parts, counting them out on my fingers, and assigning each of my classmates their obvious role. Clara, the Nutcracker Prince, Snow Queen, Snow King, Uncle Drosselmeyer, Arabian Coffee, Chinese Tea, the Russian dancers, the mechanical doll and harlequin, the Spanish dancers, snowflakes, the sugar plum fairy, reed flutes, dewdrop fairy, mother ginger. It's not till the end of the list that I realize my mistake. I didn't cast myself. Winter performance, The Nutcracker. Cast. Major soloist parts. Clara, Maura James. Older Clara, Edith Diaz. The Nutcracker Prince, Alec Lucas. Snow Queen, Bet Abney. Snow Queen understudy, Eleanor Alexander. Snow King, Henri Dubois. Drosselmeyer, William O'Reilly. Arabian Coffee, Liz Walsh. Chinese Tea, Seijin Kwan, Heiji Yi. Sugar Plum Fairy, Giselle Stewart. Sugar Plum understudy, Lee Jun Kim. Rat King, Douglas Carter. Dewdrop Fairy, Michelle Dumont.
Chapter 4. Gigi. It's midnight. Casting day is officially over. The shock and the excitement of it all keeps me up. I am the Sugar Plum Fairy. Me, Giselle Stewart. I am Mr. K's Karichneveya Babushka, his brown butterfly. I let the words flutter around in my head, like my own little butterflies in my windowsill terrarium, all light and frantic and impossibly beautiful. They keep me company here. I got a handful of congratulations that felt mostly strange and hollow, and a few stiff hugs, like it was all for Mr. K and the teachers who were watching. I can't stop thinking, fidgeting. My muscles itch to move even this late, past curfew, past lights out. It's the only way I'll be able to clear my head, get some sleep, and be fresh for morning ballet class tomorrow. I slip out of bed and tiptoe from my side of the room, careful not to wake my roommate June, on my way out. I listen for the nighttime RA patrolling in the girls' hall before sneaking out. I should rest. Mama would insist on it if I were home. It's the healthy thing to do. But I know what I really need is to dance, especially now. I need space to think it through. I need space to get ready for it all. The elevators have cameras, so I take the stairs down 11 flights to the first floor. I don't want anyone to know I'm out of bed. I'm a bit breathless as I tiptoe to my secret place, passing the administrative offices, through the lobby, and dashing from hall plant to hall plant, hoping not to be spotted by the front desk security guard. The whispers from earlier follow me, buzzing in my ears and my head, as if the parents and other dancers were still standing there, mocking me. The black girl, the new girl. She's no Sugar Plum Fairy. Her feet are bad. Her legs are too muscular. Her face won't look right on stage. It should have been Bet. Bet's sister was luminous. You heard Mr. K say it. Gigi could never be that. The ghost's words push me forward. I walk as quietly as possible down the hall. The Ballet Conservatory is at the back of the Lincoln Center complex, in one of the beautiful buildings that makes up the Performing Arts Center. The first time I walked along the promenade, it seemed impossible that there was a place that housed it all. Dance. Theater, film, music, opera, and more. The studios on the first floor are glass boxes that let in light. I graze my fingers along the cool panels as I pass. I hold my breath and duck past the nutritionist's office. Her charts and scales and cold metal examining table provoke hysteria, and the tiny woman wields the power to boot a dancer out of the conservatory for falling underweight. It's enough to keep me eating, that's for sure. I jump when I catch sight of Alex slipping out of one of the studios. It's the middle of the night, practically. Our eyes meet. I open and shut my mouth like a fish and start to mumble out some explanation for why I'm down here. He smiles like he's not going to tell anyone. "What are you doing up?" Alex says, grabbing my hand and leading me to a dark spot in a hallway away from a camera. The gesture means nothing, of course. He belongs to Bet, whose face is porcelain and smooth and whose words and expressions are so carefully chosen, they are always dead perfect. My hair is frizzy and wild, and I never say the right thing. I hope my hand isn't clammy. They're always watching, he whispers. You've got to know where to hide. His body is close to mine. He smells good, especially for someone who's been dancing all evening. And I take an illicit breath of his woodsy deodorant and the sweetness of new sweat making his forearms glisten in the dark. I like to dance at night, I say, trying to remember how easy talking used to be back in California. I go to the locked-up studio, the one in the basement. I don't know why I tell him this. Just came from a late-night workout myself, he says. I try on a smile and force myself to hold on to Alex's eye contact. Secretly, I'm wondering about him, why he dances, what he dreams about, what kissing him might be like. I've never really been this curious about a boy before. Boys are distractions. Well, to ballerinas, not to normal girls. Beth's boyfriend, I say in my head, even as I take note of how wide his shoulders are, how I can make out the shapes of the muscles under his tights and hoodie. There's something so romantic about a ballerina couple. You can't help admiring their beauty and symmetry when they walk down the hall together. Long limbs and blonde hair and a graceful ease that can't be denied. And on stage, I bet the audience can sense that they're together. I mean, obviously. You won't tell on me, will you? I try to flirt like girls in the movies. I won't tell if you don't. Sugar plum fairy. He mock whispers. There's nothing sinister in the words, no threat. If anything, there's a laugh underneath it all. I smile back. I'm not sure anyone has really smiled at me for the entire month I've been here, though he's always been so nice to me. Deal, I say, and reach out to touch his arm. I don't know why. The deal doesn't require a touch to lock it in, but letting my fingers rest on his strong forearms is a strange reflex. His muscles tense, but he doesn't pull away immediately. You're an interesting choice for a sugar plum fairy, Alex says. I don't know what to say to that. I mean, you'll bring a lot of energy to the role, he says, filling the space where I am not talking. His arm grazes mine, a breath between our skin, so close I can feel the heat of it, but neither of us moves away to get more space. Thank you, I say, letting myself believe, for just one second, that Alec is just as curious about me as I am about him. Didn't Cassandra dance it last year? Wasn't she only a sophomore? I don't know why I say it, and I wish I could erase the words after seeing his face twist into a pained expression. He nods. Yeah, she did. Cassie's my cousin. A strange silence stretches between the two of us. No one really speaks about the girl who left last year, which makes me sad and curious. And I didn't know she was his cousin. I start to say I'm sorry. It's cool. Let's not talk about it. Let's talk about you dancing the role. It's not lost on me that Alex smiles when I smile right now, or the way his eyes light up when I say in way too small a voice that I'm excited to work with him. And he doesn't move away. I wonder if he needs to get back upstairs to his room, if he needs to get some sleep. I'm excited to work with you too, he says, the blueness of his eyes glowing even brighter. There's a noise at the opposite end of the hall. He moves away. See you tomorrow, okay? He asks. Yeah, I say. Don't stay up too late, he says, and walks in the opposite direction, leaving me to think over the words and the light touch while I walk farther down the hall, farther into the dark. The corridor dead ends at a staircase that leads down into the basement level. I've noticed people never walk this far down the hall. I race down. This area is separate from the student rec lounge and the physical therapy room, like it has been purposefully blocked off. There's a studio here that's locked up. A small studio window gives a view inside, the shadowy outline of stored objects. The first week of school, I'd asked June about the unused studio, and she said it had always been under construction and that the teachers hated it because it had no windows and ballet needs light. The Russians call it Plekhaya Energia, a room brimming with bad luck and darkness, and so it isn't used. But I don't believe in superstitions. I don't exit the dressing room with my left foot first, or sew a lucky charm into my tutu, or kiss the ground in the stage wings before going on for a performance, or need other dancers to say mir to me on opening night. At home, my parents have their silly broom to sweep out evil, and often burn sage to keep the house energy clean. But I only believe in my feet, and what they can do in pointe shoes. I pull a bobby pin out from my bun and push it into the old lock, waiting for the tiny bolt to ease downward and click out of place. I like to be in places where I'm not supposed to be, in my old high school's attic or in the empty house in my San Fran neighborhood. There's a tiny thrill in picking a lock and exploring a space that others want closed up. The lock gives without much effort. I look to the left, then to the right, and disappear into the dark space. Dirt and debris crunch under my sandals, and I run my hand along the wall and click a switch. The one working light sputters and then buzzes on. The bare light bulb flickers an erratic pulse. Its half light illuminates covered objects, a partially gutted dance floor, and mirrors draped with black sheets. Broken and decayed bar poles lean at odd angles, coated in a constellation of cobwebs and dust. The air is thick and inviting. I head to my little corner, plop down my dance bag, and inspect myself in the only uncovered mirror. Descending from the upper corner of the glass, a tiny fracture stretches across my reflection like a lightning bolt. Mama says looking into a broken mirror is bad luck, but I don't care. My lip has a hilly scab. I can't believe I bit it so badly, that my nerves made me do that. The ugly aberration replaces whatever is pretty about my face. I won't let myself get nervous like that again. My phone buzzes in my bag, my parents. They know I'm still up. I click them to voicemail. I know what they want. They'll ask if the nurse checked me after the castless excitement. They'll gloss over my accomplishment, only wanting to know how I'm feeling physically. Since I came out here, they treat me like I'm sick, some patient who shouldn't be out, or who should be in a wheelchair, or better yet, a bubble. I was officially cleared to dance at the conservatory months ago. I try not to think about it. I don't want anyone to know. Ever. I turn on the music on my cell phone. The Nutcracker score sounds tinny and distant, but it will have to do. I need to dance. I dig my pointe shoes out of my messy bag and put them on. My legs start first, extending out of my hips so far I feel like I'm on stilts, long and tall. I stretch from the top of my head down to my tiptoes, trying to become one straight line. As I dance, my mind quiets and my body takes over. I follow the current of music, each chord a wave, each note a splash. My feet move to match the rhythm, drawing crazy, invisible patterns on the floor. My heart's racing. I tell myself it's just from the dance and the excitement of landing the role, but a voice in my head whispers that it's because I'm thinking of Alec too. Bet's Alec. My chest tightens. Control your breathing. I haven't had one episode. Not in ballet class, not in Pilates, not in character dance, not even once all last year at my old regular school. I'm fine. I will my heart to slow. I'm in control of my body. I come down off point, wipe the sweat from my forehead, and put my hands on my head until I can catch my breath. If I stretch a bit, maybe I'll relax even more. If I focus on the deep pulls in my muscles, I can get it together. I push my leg across the bar to feel the stretch and the calm that usually comes afterward. My muscles tremble. My feet spasm. My hands shake. My fingernails are purple. The light flickers off for a long moment. Sad darkness surrounds me until the light comes on again. Maybe I'm not good enough to dance the Sugar Plum Fairy. Maybe I'm not cut out for the role. Maybe I'll disappoint Mr. K and Alec and prove everyone right. Maybe Mama was right. I'm not well enough to dance. Shut up, I say to the mirror. Chill out. I fight the negativity. I got the role. My heart's not slowing down. This hasn't happened in a whole year. My body usually obeys. I sit on the floor and press the soles of my feet together so that my legs form butterfly wings. I press on my knees. I try to breathe like a yogi, deep, slow breaths. Nothing will take this away from me. Nothing.
Chapter 5. Bet. No one has spoken to me since the cast list went up, not even Eleanor, who is breathing heavily in the bed next to mine, so comfortable with mediocrity as an understudy that she can sleep right through her failure. I do all the tricks, counting sheep, picturing myself afloat on the ocean, pretending my body is filling with grains of sand and getting heavier and heavier. It does nothing for me. On endless loop is one impossible thought. I am not the Sugar Plum Fairy. I am not the Sugar Plum Fairy. I assume I have text messages on my phone from Alec, checking to make sure I'm okay after I ran off and hid in my room, but nothing can interrupt the flow of those words and their hold on my mind. Which is why it takes me a few moments to register the loud knocking at our door at 1 o'clock in the morning, when the dorm should be all silence except for roommate whispers or secret hookups.
Bet?
Eleanor says, and it's her voice, sleepy and soft, that breaks through the loop. Then the harsh knocking and our RA calling out my name, louder and louder. Jesus, what's going on? I say, and get myself out of bed and to the door. Eleanor moves more slowly, rubbing her eyes and grumbling about the time and the noise. Our sour-faced RA is at the door when I open it, and she rubs her knuckles as if the incessant knocking has caused her an injury. She does not look pleased. Then again, neither do I. Your mother, she says. You can't send her away? I say. Eleanor is awake enough to scoff behind me. So not my job, our RA says, and she stomps off, slamming the door to her room behind her, and probably waking up the students who didn't already stir from all the knocking. A few people have opened their doors, and others are shuffling behind them. The gutsier ones take the elevator right after me and come down to the parents' lounge on the first floor, though Eleanor tries to motion them away and Liz threatens them with bodily harm. It's useless. My mother always puts on a show, and they know it. Besides, these girls have been waiting a decade for my downfall. They wouldn't miss it for the world. She's right outside the elevator when the doors open, moments away from heading up without permission. Steely, skinny, mouth in a line so straight I could use it as a ruler. My mother. She smells like red wine and rare steak and the angry kind of sweat. Bet, my mother says. Her lips tight and too pink from Chanel lipstick, which has been hurriedly drawn on over red wine-stained lips. The T's in my name land hard. She pulls me past the front desk and toward Studio C. The three other elevators open with a ping. More students pour out. She doesn't seem to notice or care. Someone laughs, but the cowards mostly hide near the elevator bank or chat up the front desk guard, waiting to hear whatever she's come to say to me. They are too far away to smell the booze on her breath or to see the unfortunate pit stains that have ruined her couture gown. But they'll be able to hear every slurred word. Next time, please tell me the truth about how your audition has gone. My mother doesn't raise her voice, not ever. It's more powerful, all low and practiced anyway, and she knows it. Even when the vowels are long and loose and the words slip on top of each other, she stays in control of the volume. We're wasps. We don't shout. "It's not like I'm some understudy mother," I say. I do not let my voice break, but my eyes are filling with tears. During the last winter ballet, I was the only level 6 girl, besides Cassie, to dance a soloist part. I was the Harlequin doll, cast with the level 7 and 8 girls. I try to remember that feeling, but my mother erases every inch of it. "I'd already called some very important people to come see you perform, Bet," she says. "You said your audition went well. I took that to mean you were ready to be seen. When your sister..." "You want to take it up with Mr. K?" I say. "I killed it. He smiled. He ever smile at Adele? At anyone? He was practically beaming." "Maybe it was because he was laughing at you. Did you ever consider that?" she says. I tell myself that she would never say this if she hadn't been drinking, but I know that's not true. She keeps that pink Chanel smile on her face, and her eyes don't leave mine. She's not that drunk. There is not a pinch of sadness or regret in the words coming out of her mouth. Eleanor and Liz slink out of the late night shadows. Our unspoken rule is that neither of them will leave me alone with my mother if things get out of control. And I guess this qualifies. Eleanor, Liz, and I give one another a look, and both of them take a few steps closer to me. "Hi, Mrs. Abney," Eleanor's voice chimes out, a welcome interruption, but too light and pretty for this time of night and this kind of conversation. "Hey, Mrs. Abney," Liz adds, her tone thick with exhaustion. My mother ignores them both. She's not done tearing me to pieces. Not yet. "You don't think. You just act," she says. "Just like your father. That's your problem." I decide not to cry at the mention of my father, but promise myself that I can feel upset about it later, alone in my room. Maybe when Eleanor is in the shower or something. "Who got it?" my mother says then. I can practically see her little ears prick up like a dog's, hunting for the next target. She's come straight from her charity event to find out the answer to this very important question. Her eyes settle on Eleanor, then comb over Liz, my only obvious competition. "Doesn't matter. Not me," I say. I didn't want to say Gigi's name. I don't want to hear the things my mother will say about her or the accusations she will make. I don't want Gigi, if she's listening somewhere with the rest of them, to think she matters to me or my mother. "Who, Bet?" She leans in a little closer, so that instead of just seeing the Chanel on her lips, I can practically taste the shit. That pitch-perfect perfume and the acidic way it mixes with her boozy breath. The combination hits my taste buds hard. "New girl," I mumble. "Oh, Christ," my mother yells, breaking her vow to stay silent and calm in spite of everything. Liz steps away. Even she can't handle it. Eleanor grabs my elbow, like I might topple over from the cruelty without her help. "Her name's Gigi," Eleanor breaks in. "She's really a totally different type from Bet, so I don't think it was even really about the dancing." She tries hard to protect me from the unstoppable gale wind that is my mother. "Gigi." My mother puts it all together. The woman spent the summer reading up on the newest recruits to the conservatory. If anyone can put a face with a name, it's her. "No. She stops. Her eyes widen as she stares at Eleanor's red face. I should feel relief. The pressure is off me so fast I almost lose my balance, all that weight just sliding away. Eleanor's grip on my elbow tightens. "Well," she says, "we can certainly fix that." I grab for her arm, knowing she's going to head right for Mr. K.
She knows he sometimes stays very late in his office. But my hand is too shaky and sweaty from the third-degree interrogation that's just gone down. And so, she escapes, her gown sweeping behind her as she makes her way to the office with a kind of singular determination only ever rivaled by my sister Adele. If I'm lucky, he's not there. And she'll just leave an angry, drunken voicemail that I hope his secretary will erase in the morning. She already has her cell phone in her hand, armed with everything she needs to make a fuss and to make a joke of our family. "It's okay," Eleanor whispers in my ear, which means it definitely isn't. Eleanor only ever says that when things are really bad. Liz doesn't say a word, just lets her forehead frown and her mouth purse, acknowledging the complete mortification of this moment. She knows it's bad. She doesn't lie to me, not even to make me feel better. Other students punch at the elevator button, no longer trying to stay quiet. There are guttural laughs and a few imitations of the great, drunk Mrs. Abney. I look over at one of the elevators. Will stands there holding it open for everyone, red hair gelled up with the color-enhancing treatment he puts in every night, his cell phone in his hand, no doubt sending out mass texts, and hopefully not video, about what just happened. And I know he's the reason half the school is down here watching in the first place. He loves seeing me fall. Eleanor tries to hold me in place, so that I don't run after the vultures, but I practically throw her off me. Maybe I got drunk on my mother's breath, I don't know. But I'm getting really tired of keeping it together, especially when it doesn't make a difference. I fly after the students, fueled with a desire to hit one of them. I almost do, too. June's just a hand's length in front of me, and I could push her too skinny ass straight into the elevator doors if I wanted. And I do want to. Just to hurt someone. Just to feel a release. Hitting her will only get me into more trouble, though, and she's not the person I hate most of all right now. "Watch out, ladies. Bet's a real animal," Will calls out with a smug grin on his face. I want to slap the look off his face, but I shove past him, past June, past all of them, making sure to elbow as many girls as possible on my way to the last elevator. I don't let anyone get in with me. It zips up to the 11th floor. I throw open the door to my bedroom, and then the door to my bathroom. And there she is, the girl I hate, the one I really want to punch. I draw my hand back, make my first real fist, and punch the mirror, hard. So hard, it shatters around my hand. So hard that sad pieces of glass clatter in the sink. So hard, my knuckles start to bleed. It hurts, but not as much as the rest of the day.